Hey, good evening. This is the August 17th meeting of the Planning Commission for Kitsap County, Department of Community Development. Welcome to all that are attending. And we will start tonight with introductions. Let's start with Central today and then go to South.
Hi there, Stephen Bow from Central Kitsap.
Okay. Alan Beam, Central Kitsap.
Okay. And then South Kitsap.
Good evening. This is Stacy Smith representing South Kitsap.
Okay. And
Carrie Kaltenborn Corey, South Kitsap.
Okay. And then North.
Hi, this is Amy Mall in North Kitsap.
And I'm Joe Phillips, North Kitsap. With that, we need to go over our virtual protocol. We do allow for 2-minute testimony or speak ideas at appropriate times during the meetings. For that, you use the raise your hand symbol on the Zoom meeting. If you're calling in, you use the *9 to signal, and then you'll be recognized. At that point, you need to use *6 to unmute your phone to speak. We also do receive, we'll take written comments. We ask that be submitted by 2 p.m. the day before the meeting. And on that, we need to, if you would write what date the meeting is for, the comments are for, your first and last name, and general location where you reside in the county. And if you could put a subject matter on it, it would help. Okay. As I stated before, 2 minutes are allowed for the public comment times. With that, do I have a motion for adoption of the agenda?
I make a motion we adopt the agenda as written.
Okay.
Second.
And I have a Smith. All those in favor of the agenda adoption, please raise your hand and let me get a count. Six. Okay, six. Commissioner Murphy, were you voting for or against? You get four. Okay, so it's 7, passes unanimously. With that, we have the next agenda item, which is adoption of the minutes. Do I have a motion to adopt the minutes for the July 20th meeting?
I'll make a motion to adopt the minutes as written.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bean. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Any discussion on the minutes there? Yes, Commissioner Kaltenborn Court.
I believe line 24 was just left over from the last minutes. It talks about June, if I'm looking at the right spot. I think that line should just be omitted.
Right.
Is that on the first page?
Yes.
It is, yep.
Because it says we're not going to consider them and then we go and consider them below. So, okay. With that correction, any other comments? No? All those in favor of adopting the minutes as presented and corrected, please signal by raising your hand yes. 1, 2. That's unanimous. Okay, that makes it easy. The next is the minutes for the August 3rd meeting. Do I have a motion to adopt the minutes for August 3rd?
I make a motion that we adopt the minutes for August 3rd.
Thank you. And a second?
Second.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Murphy. All those in favor of adopting the, do we have any corrections or comments? No, no discussion? Okay. All those in favor of adopting the August 3rd minutes as presented, please raise your hands, signal affirmative. And that's unanimous. Okay. That completes the adoption of minutes. And we come to our first public comment period. And Mr. Palmer, you are allowed. Yes. Go ahead and unmute yourself. There we are.
I think I did.
Yep.
Good evening. I want to recall the last Planning Commission meeting when there was a mention regarding the code update of the things that the code update will address. I was still concerned that there's no metric for either housing equity and diversity. How do you measure that in the context of this code? How do you measure it in the implementation of the code? And particularly, I'm concerned that making the code easier to use is not manifest in the proposed document. I would call the commission's attention to the fact that currently in the zoning ordinance, the footnotes take up about 8 to 10 pages only. They've been expanded to 48 pages in the proposal, and I'm concerned about that because what that represents is regulation creep. And because I'm a person who has direct experience processing permits for clients, I'm watching the county's process being totally bogged down. They can't process anything in about less than a year and a half to 2 years. This, in my opinion, this code will make it worse. Because of trying to find which regulation applies to what aspect of your use is going to be a continual problem. And we're already beyond what an average citizen can do to negotiate this code, as it is, without all the new stuff. So when I talk about regulation creep, there's a real impact on the people of Kitsap County. And I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about it as a professional planner, and I'm concerned about it as the president of the Kitsap Alliance of Property Owners. It's causing, among other things, the cost of housing to increase.
And okay, I appreciate your comments. We've reached a 2 minutes limit there, Mr. Palmer. Please remember that when we get to public comment, that's when it becomes official on the comments you're making, but we do hear you. Okay, any other comments from the audience or attendees? I don't see anyone going once, twice. Okay, we will close the general public comment period for now and go to the work study for the zoning use table update. Mr. Gurney.
Thank you, Commissioner Phillips. I'm starting to hear an echo, I believe. So for the record, Darren Gurney with Kitsap County DCD. Long range planning and working on the zoning use table update as a project lead. We also have with us Liz Williams tonight and Jeffrey Mack, Melissa Schumake. So I'd like to thank them for their help thus far in getting this thing through to public process. I'm going to share my screen. Okay, so for this evening, as mentioned, this is a work study to review the draft ordinance and supporting materials that were released on Friday, July 30th. And this is going to include, as per the norm, a brief review of project goals, where the department is at in the update process, and the next steps as we move forward. Tonight is set up as more of getting into a question and answer session to dive into the details of the project, things that you may need clarification or you have concerns about. That is the motivation behind tonight's meeting. So the goal of the project is to reduce barriers to investments in urban growth areas, in limited areas and more intense rural development, and rural and commercial industrial zones. This is accomplished through promoting housing equity and diversity, and that encourages a wide array of housing types within the various urban and landward zones. And that includes addressing gaps in the land use categories and definitions. The proposal also adds changes to encourage economic development by scaling land uses and streamlining the level of permit review required and adding new land uses based on projects submitted to the department. Also through a comparison of other jurisdictions. And then finally, of course, the proposed changes are intended to make the code easier to use by improving predictability and ease of use for applicants and permit users. I will address Mr. Palmer's comments a little bit later in the presentation here, so I do not want that to get lost. quickly, where we are in the process. July 20th, the department reviewed summary of an amendments matrix and preliminary draft feedback. That was ahead of releasing the draft. Before the meeting on the 20th, we reviewed a brief history of zoning use table update, the process to date, and information regarding the process moving forward. This was to bring awareness. Our first study session here on the 17th is one of two. The second is occurring on September 7th. And a public hearing on September 21st. I'm actually going to go to our process slide here. So the Board of County Commissioner public process will start in January of 2022 with an expected adoption in March of 2022. And this schedule provides both Planning Commission and the Board with an opportunity to be flexible and extend the written comment period for a week beyond the 30-day official comment period, and that's with minimal to no effects on the remaining schedule. As mentioned, we did release a final draft, a public draft on the 30th of July, and on the 3rd of August, so just a couple days after that, we met with the Planning Commission and we reviewed each of the documents at kind of the higher level, provided an opportunity for the initial questions and answers to aid in the review over the coming months. However, that meeting did not provide the detail and the opportunity to review the documents well in advance of the meeting. So you only had 2 days to review it before the last meeting. So now we're at a point where you've had a couple of weeks to absorb the material. And tonight we are conducting our study session to discuss these elements in detail. So we're going to answer questions as we can If we can't, we're going to capture those questions and answer them hopefully at the second study session. I would like to mention that we did have a meeting recently with Kingston Citizens Advisory Council on the 11th. That was one of the meetings with the community advisory groups that would have occurred in July, except for the time frame of their meetings. But in that meeting setting, we did receive some feedback regarding comments on how the proposal actually considers housing equity, and received appreciation for the fact that we were looking into that as one of the key factors as we move forward with the proposal. So I guess to speak to Mr. Palmer's questions up front here, because the equity piece was mentioned, that equity piece from the perspective of the proposal is trying to allow more opportunities for different products, different housing types. That's where the housing equity and diversity comes into play. The county cannot force somebody to build certain products. So we are in the role of providing the opportunity to build those housing product types. So that's where we are expanding the opportunities for equity and diversity with this code update. With regards to the code being longer, I guess in terms of the footnotes, being expanded from 8 to 10 pages to 40 pages, there is a lengthier amount of pages, but that content, a lot of that content remains the same. So in terms of adding regulation, just because the number of pages are being expanded, it doesn't mean that we're adding regulations to it. Yes?
Sorry, I thought you were moving on from that one. Before you end that, I'd like to speak to that one really quick.
Okay. So just to put it in perspective, yes, it is 40 pages, but if you add a section number for each one of those categorical uses, imagine adding a section number for every single footnote, that would expand that out dramatically. And we do also have new categorical uses that we are proposing to add to the table. If they are omitted from the table, they are presumed to be prohibited. So we're newly allowing uses, but some of those did require some standards to go along with them. Go ahead, Jeff, if you'd like to.
Oh yeah, just one of the things for clarification on that. There was actually reduction in the total number of footnotes. I believe, was it 105 that were removed, Darren? How many footnotes was it that we pulled off as we were moving through it?
Number of footnotes, we removed all but 6. And we were at 100 and, 14, something like that.
Yeah, so the reason that it looks like it expanded is that previously when you used the use table, you needed to go to the table and look at it and say, I was going to go ahead and do a home business. And as you would slide over to your zoning, there would be a stack of numbers that you would look at, 5, 6, 9, 2, that could all apply as to even if that was a permissible use. And then it was dependent upon the person using the table to then scroll to the bottom to look up what those numbers meant. And what happened a lot is the layperson went through it to use it. They became confused. They didn't go look that up. They moved down a path towards thinking that was permissible without actually looking at what some other underlying requirements were for it. So in this layout, when you go to the section to see what that use is, it's going to spell out right there exactly what it is. There is no hidden bite you footnote that you happen to miss as you go through the table. You go to the section, they're laid out there, and I think it's down to 6, like Darren had said. So this is for clarity of those using the table. It looks like an expansion, but it's because when you go to the section, you're now looking in one section as opposed to trying to look in 2 different spots, hoping that you catch an annotation on a table that there was extra requirements. Sorry, Darren, go ahead.
Quite all right. Thank you, Jeff. let's see if I can get back here. So in light of that, one of the purposes of the zoning use table, or non-purposes, I guess I should phrase it, we are not revising the comprehensive plan goals and policies as part of this update, and we are also not revising other development requirements in Title 17, such as the allowed density or the purpose of a zone. Those elements are something that goes beyond the scope of the project, would require a much larger amount of analysis to accomplish any kind of changes in those sections. So as we move forward, it's just be good to be cognizant that we are aware of changes that may need to occur, but that would be part of a different update effort. So finally, with going through public participation, I believe you've seen this slide on multiple occasions. We do have a couple of consultation requests that we have received, and we're currently going to be meeting with, I believe, a couple of groups in the next week. I don't believe we have a date set, but we are still accepting consultations upon request to clarify the proposal. We have our webpage up and running, all documents at the forefront of that webpage. We are coordinating with the local jurisdictions. We did go out to the CACs to present for awareness. We had a press release that went out with our proposal and staff report. Coming up in August, actually 2 days from now, we have our first virtual meeting. And that is primarily to allow the public to get into a question and answer session with the department for clarification. It's not always easy to do that in a work study forum for the public. So this is an opportunity for them to learn more. Media, we typically have our media outlets, could see some stories that come through, through newspaper media, television, radio, any of those media outlets could be part of this if it gets picked up. State Environmental Policy Act, the SEPA public comment period, that is going to be starting such that the 14-day comment period ends on the day of the public hearing. Our open public comment period for the entire ordinance, separate from the SEPA comment period, that is starting this Friday on August 20th. And that is leading up into our public hearings. So with our public hearing set for the 21st, we do have a good amount of information here to go through. We did review each of these items and high level before, as mentioned. Our staff report does outline the context of why we're proposing changes and the basis for our analysis, the rationale for why we are recommending what we are. The ordinance is our formal document that we are moving forward through the process. Applies countywide, so we have a basic map in there. Our SEPA checklist identifies how we're approaching this in terms of SEPA determination. We are expecting a determination of non-significance, but this is still in process. So that determination will be coming out shortly for public comment. Our supplemental materials, scope of amendments matrix, that's our high level general understanding of what is changing. Purpose statements, that is very specific for how we established the permit review for each zone, for each use, all based on the zone intent. Preliminary feedback document, that is something that we reviewed 2 meetings ago that informed our proposal in many ways, but the proposal itself is our response back to that feedback document. We did look over the definitions in the detailed changes attachment. This gets into the red line format that clearly identifies what is changing, what's new, what's being removed. That is in our red underline strikeout format, as well as our fifth attachment, the detailed changes for allowed use tables. This attachment is meant to clarify where we're adding uses, where they're being split, where they're being rolled up into another use. And I'll get into a little bit more detail on that shortly. And then our footnote relocation guide, that is, as we just previously mentioned, it's relocating our footnotes into a section for allowed use standards, and that is in 17.4.1.5. That includes the categorical uses and any applicable regulations from the use table that would go underneath that categorical use. Something to note for our footnotes, we do have a unique situation where our footnote one for our tables guides you to another set of footnotes. This relocation guide actually captures all of those. And it also identifies if there's changes in the language as it moves over and transitions into the new sections. So with the project, coming from our staff report, this is our comprehensive plan consistency. We do believe this is consistent with our comprehensive plan, the goals and policies. Identified pages for you here if you're looking for specifics, but land use goals and policies, economic development, each of these items were something that we referenced when we were developing this plan. We did reach out to each of these areas through interdepartment meetings, as well as going out to the community groups. We did our initial survey, if you can recall, that was a countywide survey. And everything is under the auspice of following these plans with their goals and policies. So taking all that feedback into consideration, these are our guiding factors. So for our next steps beyond tonight, as mentioned, we have our meeting on September 7th to continue reviewing detailed elements of the proposal. Our virtual meetings starting at 5:30 this Thursday on the 19th. And another on September 16th. Our written public comment period is August 20th through September 21st. That extends into the Planning Commission public hearing on the 21st. So initially, I wanted to stop here, ask Planning Commission if you had questions. We can get into more detail. Really wanted to understand where the Planning Commission is at. I will mention that the last time that I brought a large project before the Planning Commission, it was wireless communication facilities. And when we were going through that in our work study, we initially had set up a very detailed effort of running through things almost in a line by line format. And we quickly had a request to allow us to answer questions and identify topics that the commissioners wanted to discuss. So at this time, I'd like to see if there's something specific or something from the proposal that needs clarification.
Okay. Right off the bat, Darren, I noticed that on your previous slide, the one before questions, we have the public comment period ending on the 21st, and then we're having a public hearing on the 21st. And you had mentioned earlier that we could extend that by 1 week, correct?
Yes.
And I personally think closing the public hearing right on the day of a public hearing and not giving people time to digest what they heard at the public hearing and commenting back to us would be somewhat disingenuous of us. I would think that we should go ahead and just state that we're going to leave the week after our meeting open for public comment.
Okay. That would be at the prerogative of the Planning Commission to choose to do that at the time. Right. So,
yeah, just a thought on that one.
And okay.
Any questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Beam.
In follow-up from Mr. Palmer's comment, can you give us a summary of the regulations you dropped and the things that you've dropped? You know, what have you made simpler?
So simplicity, good question. So part of this—
I want to go through the footnote relocation guide because I think that provides a really good overview of the footnotes that are being removed as part of this update process.
Yes. Let me find that guide. So this is going to be your attachment D6, our detailed changes for the footnote relocation. You'll note that in some of these locations, you have items that are removed completely. So while some footnotes are being transferred, there are some that are being taken out completely. So for example, the minimum setbacks of 20 feet from abutting right-of-way. This is something that we are proposing to remove. Of course, this was technically removed with the ag code at that time. So we are removing footnote 3. So that was applied to duplexes in these zones, rural residential, rural protection, rural wooded, forest resource lands, urban restricted, urban low, the Keyport residential zones, and the Manchester residential zones. So the department reviews building permits against minimum density. Part of this footnote was geared towards ensuring that minimum density was achieved. So that is a footnote that we're removing. Likewise, as if when you move down the table here, you'll see that there are footnotes that are being removed that were specific to certain zones. Those are something that, like veterinary clinics, let me see here, in urban high, it seemed onerous to only have that apply to the urban high zone. And it already requires an administrative conditional use permit, so we can condition that anyways through the permit. So these are the kind of things that that we are removing. We also have a large section of footnotes that are being removed as a result of, let's see here. That is the wrong one. So we have a footnote that's for Community of Kingston. We already have that in appendix in 17700. So it's already required. So some of these are removal of an actual requirement. Some of them are just removing redundancy in the language. So by removing the redundancy, the implication is that that would simplify so that it's not showing up multiple locations where you have to read it the same thing every time.
The other thing I would add to this conversation, sorry to jump in, Amanda, for the minutes. This is Liz Williams for the record. But wanted to also mention to streamline and simplify for folks and create some predictability, you'll notice that new definitions have been added throughout the code to define, I believe the number's 88, was it, Darren? Uses that currently do not have definitions, which creates kind of unpredictability during the permit review process for applicants and permit reviewers because there isn't that definition to take a look at to see if the proposed use aligns with that. So that can create time and additional back and forth between the department and permit applications. So that's another example of where we tried to simplify and make the code easier to use for both permit applicants and reviewers. in addition to the reorganization into the chapter that Jeff and Darren mentioned earlier, 17415, that does then provide a direct link to an allowed use from the use table itself. So a hyperlink, which will take you right to that section of code. So you don't have to hunt around for those footnote annotations that Jeff had mentioned earlier. So those are just a few additional items that we've incorporated in this proposal.
You beat me to it. That was my next one. Are you looking for more clarification on that one, Commissioner Beam, or is that?
Oh, sorry.
Answering your question.
You talked about simplification. And I just wanted to give you a chance to say where we're simplifying and removing okay. requirements.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Can I also add, I really appreciated the attachment 1D, the scoping amendment matrix that really outlined using those three topic areas and how the changes are easily identified. So that's another document that Darren and the team has provided us that I found really helpful when I looked at how the code was made easier. Right, that one, page 6 and 7, yeah.
You're on mute, Darren.
Oh, I was saying you guys are anticipating all of my moves here. Each document that you're referencing is the next one I have queued up. So yes, this document is also helping to identify what's making it easier. If you scroll to the bottom for formatting purposes, ease of use, that's where we get into the definitions, the footnotes. We are transferring uses from other locations in code. So footnote 34, this is a good example actually. Footnote 34 is bed and breakfast that also applies to vacation rentals. That is brought into the use table and broken into the footnote. The way it's written is 1 to 5 rooms, excuse me, has a certain level of permit review. Anything above that requires more. So we did not change the level of permit review for this specific use. You will note that in some locations, there may be a change in home business. This might be one where there are changes reflected in the use table. And there was some confusion about home businesses and whether a certain type of permit was required. So this is meant to clearly identify what permit is required instead of having to read a full page of footnote to figure out which home business you're actually applying for. Marijuana is a section in code that also establishes use by zone. So that was brought in for each of those items. You have the retailer, processor, producer, and each of these tiers had a different slightly different permissibility with it. So each of these items is meant to make the code easier to use. And then as Liz mentioned, you have the format itself with hyperlinks. And then finally, for ease of use, Port Gamble with its appendix, pulling in the appendix reduced a lot of extra footnote transition and very specific language. It made it a very clear, succinct appendix that only applied to those areas within the Port Gamble redevelopment plan area. Okay. So any more general questions as we're going? Okay.
Commissioner Beam.
When you have things like you've got shown there, the living rooms 1 to 6, 7 or more, when you've got a range, how sensitive are that ranges? Are you doing it at a logical breaking point? How did you determine what ranges to use?
Excuse me again, Darren. Sorry. There you go. Another good question to ask. Group living is one that is based on the number of rooms. I'm actually going to pull up the definition here. avert your eyes from scrolling if you don't like it. Okay, so group living is definitely it's a large category that is rolling up a lot of uses into it. The 1 to 6 rooms, that specifically came from when we were dealing with adult family homes and 1 to 6 rooms, state definitions. That's where this came into play. And instead of trying to identify different room requirements for all these different things, we tried to simplify it by grouping it into one category. It also didn't make sense when a lot of these have similar impacts to adjacent properties. It didn't make sense to have multiple categories with the same permissibility requirements. So that's where you get the breaking point. If you look at one that's not the most applicable to Kitsap County because we don't have many research facilities, but research facilities, that was broken out into scales that was based on the existing scaling factor of retail and merchandise square footage. Those two categorical uses had a threshold breakdown that we followed for research facilities. We also included a couple other logical breakdowns in categorical uses. Let's see if I can pull up.
I was interested in the one lounge schools where 8,000 square feet came up. And I was wondering how you came up with that number for schools.
That one I may have to get back to you to make sure that I have the correct answer on it.
But you're saying most of these have basis in law or in regulations already, and you're just putting them into the code.
Yes. I think it's more so based on the potential impacts to the neighborhood and compatibility considerations associated with those uses and the scale in terms of trying to afford opportunities for these uses in more areas and reduce the permit level of permit review where feasible to help aid in expediting that review through the permit process. But not, you know, impacting negatively the surrounding neighborhood. And so that really, I think, is the basis for why you're seeing the thresholds that have been proposed. But welcome feedback specifically related to those scaling from the Planning Commission or the public on what would be a better threshold, just keeping in mind that we do need to consider neighborhood impacts associated with those uses.
And specifically, Commissioner Beam, to maybe like the schools when you're looking at it with the 8,000, be the difference between like a Montessori versus a high school. While they're still in the same classification, you could have a Montessori that could go in much quicker in a different location than where you would zone a large school.
Yeah, it just seemed that 8,000 was an arbitrary number, and I was just wondering how that came up.
A lot, we can look into that, so the specifics on that, but a lot of the difference we've looked at is also research for other jurisdictions as to the breakdowns and where those dividings have been, and also some of the impacts potentially associated with those to the neighborhood, as Liz mentioned. But we'll get back to you on that one.
Commissioner Smith.
So it's ironic that you had pulled up the group living section because that was the one area of definitions I did have a question about. So if we could revisit that document and that section very quickly by sharing your screen. You had items under group living D as in dog and J as in Jones. Those were the two items that were, they are very similar, if not the same living, residential living, settings. And so I was wondering why there was that separation. So D was like convalescent, nursing, yes, and rest homes, and J is skilled nursing care facility. I mean, my normal job, my day job is overseeing this system of care in Kitsap County, and these are the same thing. So I'm wondering from a DCD perspective, from a tables perspective, what's the difference, or is there a difference?
good question again. So many of these pieces that came through the group living category, we did confer with Housing and Human Services and did an extensive review of all the different nomenclatures in state law for different types of facilities. So there are slight differences between some of these things, even though the title can be one thing, there's a slight difference in the definition in state level. But that is, I guess, while we're checking this, I'm gonna try and look up and see if we have that defined separately within our document.
Or send that to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to add, Stacy, based on kind of review of, as Darren mentioned, the different categories in state law associated with housing, this is consolidating all of these uses under one category. So they used to formerly in our existing use table, like convalescent care and assisted living facilities are two separate uses. And so there was a recognition in our discussions with Human Services about how a lot of these group living facilities do have a lot of similar impacts and uses associated with them. And so that's where you're seeing this consolidation of categories, combining of categories versus splitting them out because they are very similar in their nature.
I guess I would just like some clarification why D and J are separated. That's the category, that's the same category. So to give you a footprint in Kitsap County, there are 9 skilled nursing beds, 23 assisted living, and 56 adult family homes. I know that off the top of my head because that's the work I do every day. So I do understand the differences, but when we talk about convalescent nursing rest home, that is the same as a skilled nursing facility. So I'm just wondering if that can be put together as opposed to pulled apart.
Yeah, it is being pulled together, and that is the intent of these changes, is to pull it together as one category versus splitting them out into separate. And a lot of this is guided by state law, so the Washington Housing Policy Act and the federal law related to ensuring that we are providing and increasing the supply of housing for persons with special needs. And so that is really what we were intending with this new category, was to ensure that our code does allow for all of these types of housing that are providing necessary across our spectrum here in Kitsap County, not splitting them out unnecessarily. So it does look like they're two separate things, but it's all considered under that group living categorical use, which would be 1 to 6 rooms and then 6 rooms or greater.
Commissioner Smith, since you've got some knowledge here, is it necessary, like in convalescent or rest homes, that a nurse be present there? Or there's, you know.
So that's how they are licensed with the Department of Health and Department of Social and Health Services under the Home and Community Service offices. So yeah, they are licensed that way too. And they primarily are called nursing homes because they're staffed by nurses. Okay. They aren't staffed by doctors. Yeah, that's the history in the naming.
Well, my experience with the in-laws is that, yeah, there's the CNAs and then you have a nurse and then, yeah, the hierarchy there. But I was just wondering if the convalescent and the rest, in a rest home, is it necessarily that a nurse is attending or available?
So convalescent and rest home are antiquated old terminology. They're not referenced anymore. That's kind of the point I'm trying to make. It's all the same.
Okay. But if the word's there and somebody's thinking of it, then that allows them to see that, okay, this applies to what I'm applying for and that.
And you know, I'm going to be really honest. That's not to say that just because we don't have maybe something that looks like a convalescent home, although I don't know what that would look like, we don't have it yet. It doesn't mean we wouldn't have it in the future. right? So I try to keep an open mind about that as well. Yeah.
Okay. I will also mention that the group living category and the family living definition, those are items that are remnants from the city of Port Orchard and what we looked at in our neighboring jurisdictions. That was an element of their code that we looked at and identified as being a good path forward. That difference between the two terms could also be a result of the fact that that list is existing in other locations. That is part of our goals is to coordinate with the jurisdictions and try and identify orderly transition. Like if annexations occur, we have to be very careful. We want to try and make sure that we're not creating non-conforming uses in other jurisdictions if and when they annex. But that is definitely something we'll take to consider.
Okay.
So good questions thus far. I guess the other thing that I can go through here is we can actually get through, we can go as we're doing right now and just try and find some questions, or I can actually run through residential uses on the table, see if there's questions about the proposal that way.
I do have a question here, or it's regarding within the permitting process. Is there a breakdown of identifying what permits are the most requested, and that kind of give us a where is the majority of DCD's permitting work going? Is it residential, community developments? What, you know, is there any kind of document like that?
I may have to defer to Jeff on this one.
So I can speak to that one. Realistically, we do have a breakdown that we do when it comes to report, and it's about 65% of all our business is residential. Move through it. So, and then there's a breakdown further into what sort of residential, whether it's over-the-counter permit, remodels, new SFR, replacement SFR, basic. And then there's a variety of when it comes to commercial, because some things are as simple as a new business comes into a location and they need a certificate of occupancy. The building already meets the classifications and the building requirement. And so it's an upgrade and a check as to where they're at. And then there's others that are tenant improvements that come in where it's a full, you know, goes from being a mercantile to say an assembly use, such as a restaurant, things of that nature. But we have a full breakdown and percentage on what those are. So
I would be interested in seeing that, just, you know, for my mind, looking at what the majority of your requests are and making sure that those codes are, you know, clear and understandable, kind of would help the majority of people that dive into the code.
We could definitely do that. What we'll do is we'll send out a link actually to all the planning commissions so they can take a look to our Power BI dashboards. Okay. The Power BI dashboard allows you to make a drawdown window and kind of select what permit styles you want to look at. You can drill into them also and see different permit styles in a table format as to what has come in and what's been looked at. So we could get you that. It gives you the ability to really look at what the majority of the business that DCD is doing.
Okay. That would be good. I appreciate that. Commissioner Mull.
I have a couple questions, but I'll start with a quick one that's follow-up to Commissioner Phillips' question. Of the residential permits for new construction, is that primarily developers, or do we see very much of people, you know, building houses on single houses on their own land?
When it comes to single family residents, the majority of ours, and I don't have the current, but it used to be that it was about, out of the total SFRs we had, it's about 60% of them were actually individuals that were building on their own property.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm surprised. That's great. So my other question is about accessory dwelling units. It seems like that's something that people or at least talking about quite a bit. And I guess my thought kind of ties in also to some of the talk about vacation rentals. I'm curious if, so here's my thought process. If the idea behind making accessory dwelling units easier is to increase the amount of housing available, I'm curious if anybody has looked into whether additional ADUs actually increase housing availability and affordability of housing, or if they tend to be more along the lines of vacation rentals that actually just increase property value. And thinking about the difference between housing affordability in terms of renting and just having people be able to find a place to live versus home ownership, which I think can be a really different thing if you're just, you know, if you're increasing the number of residences, but those residences are all owned by, you know, the same people who already have a lot of resources. So if you have any thoughts along those lines, I would be happy to hear them.
So we could talk on that a little bit. There are some case law already that calls out and has identified that ADUs are viewed when it comes to density as an increase in density. That's one of the reasons when it comes to the rural areas, when you look at it, that ADUs are difficult to really kind of deal with because it's viewed as an increase in density. As we know, GMA's the goal is to drive growth into the UGA and the urban areas first, increase the density and the infrastructure there before there's an expansion of the UGA and then, you know, wash and repeat, right? That is kind of the goal. The ADUs are a little different in how they provide some of that housing affordability. The idea with an ADU is that we create another potentially rental unit, really, when you look at it, or the availability even possibly for a family member that might stay with you to live. So the affordability aspect comes in that. When you look at the urban areas and trying to make those a little easier to permit, the idea is that those would be something that would be looked at as advantageous, or that you'd have the ability to do in an easier manner. Whereas you can't put a full second house on, you do have the ability to provide a living unit for someone to come at a much cheaper rate based on some of the restrictions that are associated with it. The size of the unit, parking density, things of that nature. When you look at it, those can all be advantageous to a person so they can move forward. The VRBO aspect of it, that kind of can change jurisdiction to jurisdiction. If you ever go look at VRBO regulation, that is controlled by different jurisdictions. Some require that a person has to actually live on site, right? So you couldn't take to put an ADU in and then use the home, let's say on waterfront. Say you happen to be in Silverdale somewhere, you put an ADU in, and now you have two VRBO properties that you're looking at. Some jurisdictions don't allow that. That's not something that Kitsap County is currently tackled. There's conversation that people have talked about it, but that's not something with COVID and everything else that's actively going on that's been an active conversation currently. Not that it won't ever come back, because there is concerns associated with that for people and the ability to maintain the character of their neighborhood when they live there. And when they moved in, it didn't turn into a full rental community all of a sudden for 2 days and 3 days at a shot. So I know that's not a full answer for what you're looking at, but it's really kind of about the best we can really give, because there are many facets that go into that when you look at it.
And wasn't there a working group that was studying the regulations on vacation rentals and bed breakfasts?
There is, yes.
On the code. So yeah, that's still... The
group is looking at that. It's still out there. It's something that's being looked right at. Because there's other concerns associated with it. Life safety would be one of the things that I would speak to. With a VRBO, while many a times when it comes to a single family residence, when we look at it, that's something that we all live in, right? It's our home, it's our safety, it's our family. But VRBOs can turn into a commercial style property with people coming in and out and going. So some of the life safety aspects and concerns associated with that, like, hey, do we have egress windows? Things of that nature. All of those are kind of things that drive the VRBO to be looked at.
And Jeff, if I can interject real quick, just to get at the permissibility requirements of this, I did want to bring up the fact that if you're looking at the tables and you are, we're looking at land use permits here. This is not for building permits. But if you're looking at land use permits, let's say that you are allowed to put in an accessory dwelling unit in one of these zones. So you're allowed to put in the accessory dwelling unit. If you start to go down the line of wanting to do bed and breakfast or vacation rentals, that use is in these zones, that use is specifically not allowed. You would have to get a separate land use permit to allow that bed and breakfast or vacation rental. So hopefully that answers your question. In terms of whether ADUs are being used as the vacation rental or bed and breakfast, I don't know if we can find that kind of information from report outs in our system.
Yeah, I don't think we have access to that information at this point, but I do know other jurisdictions have done some survey work on the kind of Bainbridge Island in particular has recently done some survey work to see how accessory dwelling units are used on the island. And that helps to inform their regulations there.
And aren't the number of ADUs actually going in very small?
We'll have a report out on that in the very near future. But yes, we are seeing in the urban areas limited new accessory dwelling units part of the evaluation. Billable lands report.
Right. I remember reading an article in the Kitsap Sun that Bremerton had only two units, that went in for permits for ADUs. So I don't know if there is a clamor to get ADUs in, but that's not part of this discussion. Commissioner Beam and then Commissioner Lyason.
Can we go back to that last graphic that you showed? You had up there business use, incidental, moderate for home use.
Where? Give me just one moment to bring that up. So,
my question is, where is it not allowed? Why would you want to, if somebody's got a home in East Podunk and he's selling eggs, why is not that allowed?
So I believe this is
the line item 134, I think.
Yeah. So.
And I just noticed that it wasn't permitted everywhere. And I was just wondering what was the decision process there?
So in terms of the table that we're looking at now, so this is our commercial and industrial table. So in the business and in the zones that you have residential uses allowed, that's where we identified, okay, we're allowing homes to be built in these zones. So where it was previously prohibited, if you have a home that's going to be allowed to be built, we're shifting to allow a home business there. Whereas in the industrial zones, we typically do not allow residential uses. Okay,
so it's... If I can build a house, I can still have an incidental use.
I want to say in most cases, yes. I hate to use absolutes, but almost in all cases, yes.
it just struck me that there were blanks on that. And I thought that's strange.
Well, blanks and also mean.
And these aren't changing. So just so you know, these aren't changing. These are existing code permissibilities.
It's 100% Commissioner Beam based on the fact that we're looking at the commercial table.
Okay.
SMRs aren't allowed okay. in the industrial area.
Okay.
I can go to the Lammard tables here. So in the commercial zone, this is where it gets a little bit interesting in that each community has their own vision and identity. And in some of those communities, they didn't want to see home businesses in their commercial zones. And so in some communities, that's what they've chosen to do. And we're trying to honor those sub-area plan visions and goals.
Yes, sir. I was just struck by blank the Blankton's.
Okay. These are all clarifying questions. It's great.
Right. Commissioner Lyason.
Good evening. This is my favorite part of our job as planning commissioners, is getting into this level of discussion. So I appreciate all the prior comments. I greatly agree with Commissioner Maul, and I would be interested in getting any of the data from, particularly from the neighboring jurisdictions, Bremerton, Bainbridge Island, that's been relaxing ADUs. If we can get any of that, that would be helpful. And if you guys are too busy, just let me know. I can email them to him. Try get it, but I'm interested in that type of information on ADUs. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, Commissioner Lyason, because what I was going to click on and say is right now, with everything going on with buildable lands and the other things that we have on the plate for action, I don't know that we have the ability or bandwidth to pull that information to provide it to you right now. There are things that are readily available on any of the jurisdiction websites, as you're aware, Commissioner Lyason. If you wish to take a look, you can pretty much Google anymore. The Google box will pretty much turn up anything for you on the ADUs and the other jurisdictions.
No problem. I was just waiting for you to authorize me to do it. You may regret it though, because last year I was researching, especially Seattle King County on ADUs, when Commissioner Shattuck in particular was pushing. And I think we made it a parking lot issue at that time, but happy to have the discussion come back, and very much interested in any data put together by the neighboring jurisdiction. So
one of the things I would say, no problem, Commissioner Elias. So one of the things I would say is right now modifying the ADUs and the UGA isn't something that's on the tip of the spear right now. We're looking at the whole table holistically and what's in the UGA. And when we look at that, ADUs are something that everyone was looked at. People want to know about them for the rural areas. There's GMA issues associated with that. People want to know about them in the UGA. The overall goal of what we're looking at with Title 17 in this update is not focused solely on housing. It's also focused on economic development, the ability to go ahead and move forward with and add small business uses into some of the rural commercial areas that exist, things of that nature, removing those impediments. It's not holistically focused on housing affordability, it's economic affordability and the ability to expand the base of where we're at. And ADUs is just one of those things that people look at because it is in that use table and does fall inside the urban growth and urban census area.
Okay, quick pause here. Amanda, are we needing to take a pause yet on the recording?
It depends on how far we are in the presentation. probably, why don't we go ahead and take a little break? That's probably a good, this is probably a good chance to.
Okay, so it is now, I have 6:38, so let's make it 6:45. 7 minutes won't hurt anything. Okay, 6:45.
Thanks.